All right, hello everyone. Welcome to Computer Science E75. This is Section 5. I'm Dan Armidaris, and of course, Cato will come up in the latter half. And so this week, we're doing all JavaScript. So again, as just like every other week where we divide, or every the other parts of the course where we divide it into two-week units, this one is about JavaScript. So we'll do some of the more basic, quote-unquote basic things this week, including form validation and event handling in the latter half, and then next week we'll get into some of the more advanced stuff where we start really making it Ajax-y, so to speak. So JavaScript, as we know, is a client-side programming language. So what does that mean for us? It's not processed on the server, it's processed by the client or by the client's web browser. So this means, unlike PHP, that all of the processing is not done on the server. So that means that any data that we send from JavaScript, we can't really trust necessarily. So for everything that we do in JavaScript in terms of validation and such, you still have to validate everything server-side, just because only everything that's happening on the server can you really truly trust. And so, of course, this being section, we do have section notes written this week by Cato, and we have very, very good section notes here on the section page. And so you can download those. Those are already available for you to use. So let's see. So let's just create just a very basic JavaScript application. And this one will create a loop that loops just 10 sentences just very, very easily onto an XHTML page. So this being an XHTML page, we need to create all the same sorts of elements that we have in any other XHTML page. So I'm just going to paste it in. So of course the doc type, the HTML tag, the head tag with the title, and the body. And all of these examples Cato has up on his website at, cater.com/section/5, I think. Yes, and so you'll be able to look at all of these examples, and we're going to be working through all of these throughout section. So back to this. All right, so we have the body. So now, in order to create, in order to embed JavaScript into an XHTML document, what do we need to do?
Put in some script,
yep, that's right. So script tags. So this is unlike PHP, where you would put in the angle bracket question mark to denote the beginning of some PHP code. You just enter the script tag, and of course you set the type to text JavaScript. And this, you can just copy-paste this basically into your own. You pretty much just need this everywhere. Yes, the question.
Why would you decide to put that in the body element instead of somewhere else?
We're going to get into why we're putting it in the body element versus otherwise in just a second. So I just want to show really quick how we denote JavaScript code, and then we'll talk about where we can place it. So beyond that, in order to create valid XHTML, we actually have to put all of the JavaScript code in cdata tags. So you put a comment, angle bracket, bang, square bracket, cdata, then another square bracket. Oops, I mistyped here. And so basically these two lines, again, you can just copy-paste into your own application or into your own web page. So then here you would put in all of your JavaScript code. And the nice thing is that JavaScript comments are the same as PHP comments, so the two double slashes here denote a comment in both. So put JavaScript code here. Now you have to close this cdata, and so you do that with double slash, two close square brackets, and a close angle bracket, and then of course we have what tags to close now in XHTML?
The script tag,
and then of course the body tag and the HTML tag. So
the
cdata, so it's just marked as, so there's variety of reasons that we do this. So first, you notice that this is a comment, so that browsers that are interpreting this, all of the data in here is JavaScript, don't interpret this C data section. But then whenever, for validity purposes, whenever the W3 validator goes through and tries to validate it, or even web browsers try to parse through this information, some of them will not recognize JavaScript code between the script tags and will call it as invalid, which is why putting it between CData tags, just like when we put basically any text, freeform text in XML between CData tags, that's the reason that we do this. And so you do the double slash for the comment and then the CData just to tell the XML parser that it's still valid code. Yes?
Does the JavaScript in the CData block show up in view source?
Does the JavaScript in the CData block show up in the view source? Yes. This is all client-side, so all of this text is going to continue to be visible on the client-side by viewing the source. So, yes. And we'll actually talk a little bit more about all this stuff in just a minute. So, this is how you can form JavaScript, or this is how you basically wrap JavaScript code into your XHTML. So now, there's normally two places that we would put this sort of code, either in the body tag or in the head tag. And the reason, the difference basically is in the head tag, it does, so you really can put this code wherever you want, but in this example, what we are going to be doing is outputting XHTML from this JavaScript by using sort of the equivalent of echo in PHP, which means that we want it to be within the body tags in this document. However, if we were just defining functions that we were going to be using, for example, for form validation, for any sort of events, for any form events, anything like that, then that sort of thing would be a better place maybe for the head tags, just because there's no XHTML that's really being output. So you can mix and match. You can put as many script elements as you want throughout your body, throughout the head, what have you. And so realize that there's even another way that we can embed JavaScript into a document. Anybody have any ideas about that one? How would we
linking
do that?
Linking to a file.
That's right. So linking to a JavaScript file. So much in the same way that we would link to much in the same way that we can define CSS either in the head or in a separate CSS file, you can think of it kind of the same way with JavaScript, where we can take all of the code, not all of this script type and the C data, but the actual JavaScript code, and create a new document. So now put JavaScript code here. It didn't make my text bigger. Hold on. Sorry, I'll make it a little bit bigger for you. So again, this is just all of my JavaScript code, and I can save this as a JavaScript file, which could be, you know, whatever .js is the convention, the JS extension. And then from there, go back to our head here. You can embed it by typing in script type. So again, with the script element, text slash JavaScript. And then defining the source with the src attribute, so my external file.js. And then, of course, you must end the script tag. So this is all in the section notes, but just to go over it quickly again, you put this in the header, or in the head tags of your document, and you do script type, text JavaScript, where the source is equal to the location of your JavaScript file. Now, this doesn't mean that your JavaScript code is any more secure or obfuscated from prying eyes, because with it being client-side, what then would the permissions have to be for a JavaScript document?
World-readable.
Yeah, world-readable. So the same as your XHTML, which is 6.4.4, which means that we can just download the .js file in the browser and just read all of the code. So just be wary that all of your JavaScript code will basically be visible to the outside world, so basically making any vulnerabilities especially easy to find. Not that your JavaScript code will perhaps make or break the security of your site, and that's why we should do the client side, or the, I'm sorry, the server side validation. So for this particular example, we don't need to reference an external JavaScript file, so I'm going to delete this reference from the head of this document. Gone? Okay. So any questions about this so far before we start diving into the code itself? None. Good. Okay. So JavaScript is very similar to C, C++, PHP, even Java, but JavaScript is not like Java, really. It's there are very, very different things, like David mentioned in class, so don't get the two confused. However, that said, we can actually do, you probably know, or just by looking at JavaScript syntax, you'll be able to figure out perhaps a great deal of what we're going to do. So in this case, we want to output a sentence, maybe a counter. Maybe this it says this is sentence number one, for example. This is sentence number two, and put it into this XHTML file. So what do we need to do in that case? What would simplify that processing?
For loop.
Yeah, for loop. Okay, good. So first we have to define a variable, which you would do with the var keyword. So var I, for example, we're just defining a variable called I in this case. It's pretty easy. So before we go on, though, realize that JavaScript, just like PHP, is very loosely typed. We're not defining what type of variable this is. We're not saying this is an integer or a string or anything like that. And this has some advantages, but also some disadvantages. I'm sure we'll explore both throughout all of our work with JavaScript. Just realize for now that the way to define a generic variable is with var. So now for loop. So this should be recognizable. So just like in PHP, you set the initial, you set what the variable should be initialized to. So I equals 1, I is less than or equal to 10. Because we want it to loop 10 times, and I++ to increment the variable. And of course, you put all of your code in curly braces to denote all of the functions or commands that you're going to run from the for loop. And from here, we're going to use a method called document.write. So we'll talk more about the DOM and what this document object actually contains in future lectures and probably future sections as well, but realize that most everything can be done from, well, that's probably a bad way of saying it, but many ways of manipulating the actual XHTML document is done with this document command. There's nothing, or with the document object. There's nothing that you need to do to initialize it. Being part of a web page already makes it initialized. So it's pretty easy to just echo this out, and so document.write is pretty much the equivalent of print or echo in PHP. However, remember that PHP is server-side, whereas JavaScript is client-side. So we'll do document.write. So this is sentence number. And now, how would we put in the number that is of this sentence? So in PHP, how would we do it? Right. Well, you'd have to use the concatenating operator, the period. So we would do a period $i. However, in JavaScript, there are a couple of differences. First of all, the concatenating operator is not a period. It is a plus. So don't get this confused, but let me just write this down. Concatenation. It's one of those words that once you learn how to spell it, you're really proud of it. Okay, so concatenation is the plus sign in JavaScript. So I'll just put JS here. And whenever you reference a variable, you do not use dollar signs. You just reference the variable name itself. So in this case, we would do plus I. Okay, to denote the I, or to get the value of the integer. So remember that I said that JavaScript is loosely typed. So what type of data is this right here? This is sentence number. String. That's a string, right. And what type of data is I? What type is implied by this for loop?
Integer.
an integer, right? So luckily for us, this is one of the advantages of this being loosely typed, is that JavaScript will actually convert I to a string in order to concatenate it onto this string that we've defined here. So there's nothing that you have to worry about. You don't have to define it as string I or anything like that. Makes it pretty easy. And then, of course, since we're outputting straight XHTML, we should probably put a line break. So you can actually output XHTML here. And we close the command with the parentheses because we had the open parentheses. And then just like PHP, you denote the end of a line with a semicolon. Okay? So unlike PHP, if you have a problem, if you forget a semicolon, and you try to run, or you try to open this file in a browser, this is what David was talking about, it's not going to give you a nice error. It's going to make a little icon somewhere in the browser window and be very vague and not help you with that. So if you want to debug JavaScript, you either have to have very sharp eyes or a good JavaScript debugger, all of which are, well, your eyes were given to you, I suppose, or grown, well, however you want to call it, and then the debuggers you can find on the website. Okay, so we have this code for this document. So now let's go ahead and save this. I'm just going to save it as an XHTML file because that's what it is on my desktop. So this will be example1.html. Save it. All right, so now I want to open it here in Firefox. Hold on, I have to find it. All right, so what do we expect to see as soon as I let go of the mouse here? What do we expect to see in the browser window?
10 lines of text.
Yep, 10 lines of text, the sentence numbers sequence from 1 all the way to 10. Okay, so let's take a look at what the source looks like. View page source. All right, so what do you think we're going to see in the source?
XHTML.
Yeah, so we're going to see XHTML, but
in what else? Raw text.
We're going to see this raw text.
With the break.
Actually, we're going to see exactly what we just typed. And the reason for that is that the browser did this document.write. So this text doesn't actually exist in the XHTML. This text right here that was output doesn't actually exist in the XHTML. It's that the browser inserted it by running that code and putting it in there. So in that way, you can actually make your site somewhat complicated by having JavaScript output all of this stuff. But this can also be confusing for you as a developer. So do be mindful of that as well. Okay.
If you did yes. View generated source and that Firefox plugin, it would show you the source for the branded page, right?
Which do you mean?
No, the developer plugin in Firefox. If you did generated source, it would show you the source of this.
So if you have the developer plugin and you do the view generated source, so I'm not actually too familiar with the plugin, but that sounds right, that if you view the generated source with the developer plugin, it would show you the actual XHTML that was generated by the browser as well. So in that way, that would make it a lot easier for you to debug what your JavaScript code is outputting by these document.writes or whatever other functions and methods you use in it. Okay. So any questions about that before we move on? All right, so one of the things that we talked about in lecture was form validation. So let's bring this back up. Let's see. Give me just 1 second. All right, so I'm actually just going to copy and paste in a form that we have. It's going to be just a very simple, basic form. Right, so here, this is a form, so we'll go through it right now. So it's you can see its method is post, and it's going to actually have an action here to the dostuff.php file, but we don't have that quite yet, but that's okay. So, and of course, you see that it has a name here. We've given it a name, my form, and there's another attribute that's important that we're going to go over in just a second. On submit. Okay, so we have a couple of input types, text boxes, check boxes, and a submit button. This should be fairly straightforward, but before we do that, or before we start getting into the actual JavaScript, I got to work on making this valid XHTML. So I will paste in a doc type. All right. Head body tag. This is not coloring it for me. All right, there we go. Body tag, and let's see, I need to close the body tag. Oh, did I close the form? Nope. Gotta close the form, close the body tag, and close the HTML tag. All right, so right now we just have a very generic form, basically, on an XHTML page. So let's just save this as example 2.html on the desktop, and then we will take a look and see what this looks like. So, oops, what did I do wrong? I forgot this. Okay, so now just what we expected, just a normal form. So this is going to post the data to a PHP file, and so from there we would be able to do any validation server side that we wanted to do. But sometimes, as was mentioned in lecture, you want to do all of this validation first. You want to do it before we actually send it to the server. So that way we can be really nice to the user and say, okay, you forgot these fields. This field should be formatted this way, just to make it easier, not only on your end, but their end as well. So in this case, what are some of the things that we should check? So let me first bring this up. So we have these input types, the text box, name, your name, and then let's see, you have a checkbox which denotes whether or not you are a student, and a school name here. So this might be some sort of registration, very simple registration page for a school or whatever. It doesn't really matter what it is, but what should we verify? What do you think we should check on this form? What are some things we should check?
They put something in for your name and school name.
Yeah, so that seems pretty simple and good to me. We should check to see what they put in, or that they have something for your name and school name. So in this case, we will create a function that will do the checking for us. And so since we're writing a function, we can just put this JavaScript that we're going to write in the head element, or between the head element, rather than putting it directly into the body. So remember, we do script tag type equals text slash JavaScript, and we'd have the C data. I always type that wrong character. Okay, C data, I forgot a square bracket. And then we have to close all of this off, so slash slash and the two square brackets, angle bracket, and close the script tag. So this is all the same thing that we just did in example 1, and remember that you can find all of this code on Cato's website and notes that are on the course website. Okay, so first we'll create a function. So you can create a function just with the function keyword here, and then you define the function name, check submission. We would put any arguments that we wanted to accept in the parentheses here, just like PHP or C++, any of these very similar languages that we would work with. And we just want to check, is the username blank? Or, well, it was called your name. Your name field blank. All right, so and again, remember that we can access just about all of the elements from that document object. And so since we had given a name to the form, it actually becomes very easy to access the form and all of the elements within that form just by calling. So we need to check if it's empty. So we'll have an if statement here, if document.myForm, because remember that we had set the name to be my form down here. So this is the form tag right here. We have method attribute, post attribute, or I'm sorry, the action attribute, and name right here is my form. Okay, so by the name we can access it by document.myForm, and now all of the children of that particular element, which are everything that are contained within the form elements, which I didn't properly tab here, so it makes it difficult to see, but all of these input types are children of this form element, right? Just like XML documents, just like everything else that we've talked about. So all of these have names as well, but the one we are interested in is this first text box called name your name. Okay, so we would access it from document.myform.yourname and compare it against the null value. But something is wrong already, and what is that? So I did document.myform.yourname equals equals blank. That's right. So this actually is not going to return the value of your name field. In order to get the value from that, you have to call that object's method value here. So we find the object, so document.myform.yourname and append dot value, and then we can test that value against whatever we want. So if we wanted it to be equal to something very specific, you could set it equal to that. But in this case, you want to test to see if it is blank. So it is blank, so we want to show an error. And you can do that very basically. It's not always best practice, but the easiest way in this case is just to use an alert. Please type your name. The alert will bring up that annoying pop-up box with the that gives the message and an OK button. This works in almost every JavaScript, or it should. It works in every JavaScript-enabled web browser. Okay, so there's another thing that we need to do. We need to return false. And what this does is it's going to exit the function and it's going to return false. And we'll see why this is important in a minute, but when a function returns false, we can actually tell the browser to not submit the form, and we'll see why this is important in just a second. So I need to close that curly brace. Let's see, so I've closed the curly brace for the function and for the if document. So let's just save this and test to see if it works. All right, so I will refresh this page, click do stuff, and it gives me the pop-up window, please type your name, and that's because I have not typed anything in. However, this is easily defeatable because remember, we just verified if it was completely blank. What if I had typed in a space, for example? Now it's not completely blank, so we are not going to get that message and it's going to do the post. However, we don't have that PHP file, so it gives us the file not found. But it's expected. It has actually sent that data. Okay, we'll address that in just a minute. But for now, we actually want to check to see also if the user has typed in a school name. So we'll do that within the same function here, function check submission, and we'll use another if statement. So help me out here. How will I form this if statement? So I have if.
What are you trying to do again?
So what I want to do is check to see if the school name is blank. So how can I check to see if the school name is blank?
Document.
Yep, so if document
myform.
Dot myform.
Dot, school.
Yeah, so the name, we'll scroll down to find the name. So this is, you'll see it's named school name here. So if document.myform.schoolname
but
dot value, good, okay, equals equals blank, then we would do the same thing. Alert, please tell us your school name. And we would return false. Okay. Now, there's actually something else that we want to check, though. So in this particular form, let's just say that the implementation is such that we want to only check the school name if that checkbox, that little checkbox that's on the page is checked. So first we want to make sure that they are a student, and if they are a student, then we want to check if their school name is entered, has been entered. So how can we modify this if statement to do that?
Say, just document my form, whatever you call the checkbox.
If document dot my form dot whatever we call the checkbox, yeah, so we'll go down here. We find that the name is student. Okay, so go back up here. If document.myform.student. So in this case, it's a checkbox. We actually don't have to use the value method, but we can do the checked method. And in this case, it will return either true or false, depending on the checked status. So if it's checked, it's obvious it will return true. Otherwise, it will return false. So in this case, only if it's checked, we can do an and. So double ampersand represent and the school name is blank, then it will give us this error and return false. Otherwise, if it's not checked, it doesn't matter if it's if the school name is blank, it's not going to give you the error. If that's if that logic is escaping you for some reason, I encourage you to continue trying with PHP, for example, because it's all sort of simple logic. So anyway, so if we get to this point now, after these two if statements, we can assume that very basically our conditions have been met, right? So now, instead of returning true, all the checks have passed, so we'll return true, and that's exactly what we'll do, return true. And this is done after the if statements, but before we close the curly braces for the function. Pretty simple, I think. So, okay, so we'll test this now just to make sure that everything's still sane. So I'll refresh so as to load the latest JavaScript that we've typed in. We already know that this is going to work, so I just want to verify if I enter in my name. This is pretty small. I wonder if I can make this bigger. Oh, good, I can. All right, so this is the form. Sorry, I didn't make this bigger before. So this is the my name field. This is the student checkbox. This is the school name field, and that's the submission or the submit button. So right now I want to test the condition that this checkbox is blank, and it will, even if this is blank, it will still let us go. So I'm just doing rigorous testing here to make sure that my code works. And you can see, even though it says file not found, that means that the form was submitted. That's the intended purpose. So, all right, so now I'll check student, and now I want to make sure that by leaving this blank, this is going to error out. So I'll click go. You'll see it says, please tell us your school name. So, yes, you had a question. The JavaScript application text at the top, not as far as I know, because I think, do you know if there's a way of changing that, Cato? I do think it is a security measure, so that way that any pop-ups that come up, so for example, it doesn't say something like Internet Explorer has detected an error in this system file, please delete it immediately or something like that, and you just believe it, rather than if you notice that it's a JavaScript application, then you will say, oh, this must not be the actual application telling me this. So, regarding that, so now I just want to make sure that it works now if the student button is checked. So we'll type in Harvard just by putting in a school name, and now it works. So now we've done some very basic client-side validation. However, what was that problem that we noticed before with this validation? It doesn't take what into account?
Blanks.
That's right, blank spaces. If someone just puts in a blank space trying to get around the system, so to speak. So what would we do in PHP to fix that sort of problem?
Trim,
right. So unfortunately, JavaScript doesn't have the equivalent of a trim function, but we can define our own. And we can define it actually with a regular expression. So let's see. Give me just one second here. All right, but before we move on to, before we move on to that, I did neglect to talk about one very important thing, and that is how we tie the JavaScript to this form. So normally, if you just type up that JavaScript, the browser isn't going to magically know how to run or why to run that JavaScript against that form. So we actually have to explicitly define it. So going back to our code here, something that was already typed out. So not only did we name, this is the form element here, not only did we list the method attribute, the action attribute, which are, of course, required for the forms, and the name, which was useful for us when typing the JavaScript itself, but we have an onSubmit attribute, which is an attribute that ties this form to JavaScript. And so realize, though, that you cannot tie this to, say, a PHP function. So if you embed at the very top, if you converted all of these, this entire function, let's just take out, for the sake of argument, this script type JavaScript and put it in angle brackets and question mark to represent that it is now PHP code. And we run this off of a server that, if you did this, it would not work because it's two different things. It's trying to run a client-side function even though this function is not being transferred from the server to the client because this is a PHP code. So realize that it can't intermix in that way. So if you want a local function check or a local form validator, you actually must use JavaScript for the function as well. So there's no easy way of getting around that. But let's just take a look a little bit more closely at this onSubmit. So let me try to change the size of this window so that we can get all of it on here. Oh, it's going to be difficult, I think. All right, so this is the onSubmit attribute in the form element. You can see that it says equals return and then the function name, check submission, and then, I mean, it's basically just a function call. Now, since we're saying return, it's going to return the value that was returned by this, which is either true or false. If the value is false, the browser is going to stop the form from being submitted. It will not submit the form, and that's exactly what we saw. It caused the alert to come up, but then it did not submit the form. When it did return true, though, indicating that the form validation was a success, the browser says, okay, this onSubmit has returned true. We can actually submit the form. And so it submits the form for processing on the server. Are there any questions about that? Okay, so there's actually a variety of really neat and really interesting attributes that we can go into, and hopefully we will have time to do all of it this first hour. So moving on, we did talk about how we're missing a trim function, though, from this, from being able to test for all of these things. So I actually want to just modify this, so I'm going to save it as a completely separate file, example 3. And let's see. Now what I want to do up here is actually define a completely separate function. So this is just separate from everything else that we've done up until this point. What I'm going to do is make use of something called prototyping, prototype.trim. So let's break this down. So you see that this is highlighting string as being some reserved word. And so this is actually a data type. It's that string data type, but it's actually an object in JavaScript. And by modifying or by accessing string.prototype, what we are saying is that we want to actually create, or we actually want to modify the string data type in some way. And in this case, what we're doing is we're adding a new method called trim here. So this method is not defined, and we need to define this trim method. And this is just one way to get the equivalent of the trim function from PHP, for example, in JavaScript. And so you could actually do this somewhat more simply by not doing prototyping at all and just by defining a function called trim and then doing whatever it is you need to do in here to actually remove all of the white space, and then you could return the string that is not a white space. But this is not as elegant, perhaps, of a solution. So what we will do, since, you know, just the working with functions is only so interesting, we will continue working with the prototype. So we're going to create this new trim method as a function. And so for those of you who are used to Lisp or Scheme or any sort of these function-based languages, we're actually creating what's called a lambda function. If you don't care about that stuff, then don't worry about it. But it's basically just a nameless function. We're just associating the function here with this new method that we're defining in string. Okay, and the way we're able to do that is with that prototype. So with function, you can do basically everything that you can with the normal function. But in this case, we just want to return something. And so I'm just going to type it out, and then we'll talk about it in just a second. So we're going to have a regular expression here. So remember that the this object refers to just what it sounds like, this. Just this object is what it is exactly referring to. So in this case, we would run this trim method from some string, correct? So from just any string. And we'll see how exactly to do that in just a second. And so this is referring to that string that this trim function is being called from. So what we're saying is to replace everything that matches the regular expression between these two slashes with nothing. So what we want to find then are spaces. So we want to replace everything that's white space with just nothing. This way, it works just like the trim function. It just removes all of the white space from a string. And so regular expressions are actually very useful to know, but it can be somewhat difficult to get through if you're not familiar. So let's see. All right. So this is the regular expression that allows us to do this. So, all right. So what this is saying is that it's going to match one or more spaces. So the space is represented by the backslash S, and the plus represents one or more then of spaces on either side of the string. So either before the string or after the string, and it's going to replace that with the null, basically. So it's just going to erase all of the strings. So just for the sake of time, I don't really mean to hand wave, but it is difficult. And do read the section notes, because it does go into a little bit more detail about how this regular expression was created. But certainly this is a pretty useful prototype that you might consider using in your own, for example. Oh, yes.
I just want to confirm that basically by using the prototype, you're adding a function to or a method to string.
Yes, by using...
versus making a whole separate world.
That's correct. So by using the prototype method, we're appending the trim method onto the string object rather than creating a different type of object altogether. So anything that's actually a string, any variable that's actually a string, we can call this trim method now from here on out. So afterwards now, let's see.
The G,
Kira, do you have a good answer for that? What the G is at the end of the regular expression?
It's the global attribute. It means that the regular expression matches multiple times. If it's emitted, the regular expression only matches once. So if we have spaces at both the beginning and the end of the word or the phrase, then we'll just get the beginning trim not. So we have to do it two times.
Okay, so just to repeat for those of you from distance, the G just represents that it's going to match the regular expression globally rather than locally, which means that it's going to run the regular expression multiple times rather than just doing it once. So rather than just removing all the spaces before the word or the string, it'll also remove all the spaces afterwards as well. So, okay.
What does the vertical bar in the middle mean?
This vertical bar in the middle. Regular expressions, those are just one of those things. Let's see.
It's or.
Okay.
So it's an or, I guess, which means that... So it means that... Right, so it's matching the white space either at the beginning or at the end, where the dollar sign, I believe, represents the end. So, okay. Moving on just a little bit here, just so we have time to continue doing this. Give me one second. Okay. So now we have appended this trim function to the string type. And so now this value right here, so now I just brought back up this JavaScript that we had created before which was the check submission function, where we checked the value to be blank, where, remember, your name was basically the field that represents your name. This value right here is a string. So now all we have to do is append dot trim, because this value method returns a string, and we've appended this trim method to it, we can now access dot trim from this value, and it will return the string with all of the white spaces removed. And so now, if we check document.myform.yourname.value.trim against an empty string, a null string, we will be able to remove all the spaces and make sure that that they have entered something other than spaces. So we'll do the same thing for the school name.value, because it is also a string. And we will save this, bring up our new page. All right, and so we'll just try this by putting in multiple spaces and whatever here. You'll see that even though we had typed in multiple spaces, which caused our first JavaScript to fail, we are now getting a please type your name message up top, which means that the trim function is working properly. Okay, so there's another thing that we could check with form validation, and that is email, basically verifying that an email address has been entered. And we can do the same thing with regular expressions, but since we don't have very much time left before the first or before the second half, I figure that we should move on and talk about So there's other event handlers. Okay, so no, I will talk about this. Sorry. I'm getting a little bit confused about how Cato and I were separating this this section. All right, so we will actually talk about how to verify an email address. So in order to do this, we can actually use a regular expression object. So all right, so what we'll do is we'll just create a new document here. And we're going to get rid of this form, just because now you see how to be able to check a form against with client-side JavaScript, and you can run a function with the onSubmit attribute in the form in order to verify. But in this case, I'm just going to simplify it a little bit and show you how to create a very basic email checker. All right, so realize that there is also another type of variable that can be defined as a regular expression variable. So I'm just going to name it regex, but it can be named anything just as any other variable. And you define it You define a regular expression variable just by putting the regular expression between slashes, as you would here. So in this case, just to do a very basic check on an email address, what should we do? Just very basic sort of email address check. What's the sort of general setup of an email address?
Something at something.
So that means that any number of characters followed by the at sign, followed by any number of characters, will just do a very rudimentary, very basic email check. And so regular expression for an actual email where you have something at any number of subdomains, .domain, .edu, or .com can actually be somewhat complex, but we'll simplify it a bit, and we'll just use something at something.com. So to represent just any character, you use a period, and of course, to represent one or more of those characters, you use it with a plus sign. So right now, we're matching one or more of any characters, followed by an at sign, followed by one or more of any characters. And so this is, like I said, a very basic regular expression, but it will get that job done. It will just check if it's something at something. Yes?
My only question is, well, how come the at symbol doesn't have to be in any kind of quotes? It's not seen as text in this case? Or?
So the at symbol doesn't have to be in quotes because it's not a reserved character in regular expressions. There are some characters that are reserved. Slashes, for example. Periods, as you can see, have meaning. So if you actually wanted to represent a period itself, you would have to escape it with a backslash. But since the at sign doesn't mean anything in this context for the regular expression, then we do not have to escape it.
And if you were looking for a name that included like the letter A or something, you wouldn't have to put that in quotes either.
So if you wanted to find something that included the letter A, it really depends on how you set up the regular expression, but you can use this sort of thing and just put in A, for example, A. But if you wanted to get a range of things, for example, you can actually define ranges with A through Z, for example, but that's all only lowercase. And so frequently what you'll see for any alphanumeric matching is they will actually define a set of characters, lowercase a through z, uppercase a through z, and the numbers 0 through 9. And so if you ever see something like that, what they're matching in that case are any alphanumeric characters. But that would exclude characters like anything that's not in those ranges. So at symbols wouldn't be, periods wouldn't be in that, exclamation points, quotes, nothing. But this is much, much simpler than even that, and it's just any character followed by the at sign followed by any character. So your question, yes?
What if I want a particular number of characters?
A particular number of characters. So
let's say I wanted a .com or something that has maybe three letters after a period or something like that.
Right, so you can actually use, it depends on how the regular expression is created, but you can actually use, you can actually set com, for example, at the end if you wanted to represent it as being just that com set of characters, C-O-M. Since there's not a range in that case, that should be okay.
Dot, 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 just for any three characters?
There becomes a point where you have to start putting these into different classes within regular expressions, such as using the square brackets to denote. And frankly, I'm a little shaky on the regular expression, so I can't answer a lot of these questions very well. It is possible to represent, if you wanted just three characters, you could define, there's a way to define that you just want three characters of something versus, where right here we have some character any number of times 1 through x, for example. So, like I said, this is very simple regular expression, but it gets the job done. So, in this case, we're just going to define an email address. So, email address as being, we'll just use our staff email address, staff at cs75.com. .net. So this would match against the regular expression because it's any number of characters followed by the at sign followed by any number of characters. So even the period is included. But remember that no period is found before the at sign, but that's okay because this period in the regular expression doesn't literally mean a period. It just means some character. So did I see a question? No. Okay. So now, since this regular expression is a regular expression object, you can actually test strings against it to see if it is, if it actually will pass. So we can do regular expression or regex.test and then type in that email addy variable. So in this case, we're just passing the email address variable into regular expression object with the test method, and it will test to see if it basically if it's matched against that regular expression. If it is, this method will return true and we'll be able to do something. If it's not, it will return false. So similarly, you can send an alert saying this is a valid address. Whoops, sorry. Otherwise, else, this is invalid. Okay. So, like I said, this regular expression is pretty simple, but it gets the job done. You can imagine that there are some cases where, I mean, you could just omit the .net, for example, the top-level domain, and it would still pass this regular expression. But finding a regular expression that matches all email address and matches them reliably is pretty difficult to do. So with that in mind, do take a look at the section notes for more information, and we'll take a 5-minute break. When we come back here, we'll talk about methods and UE a little bit.
All right, welcome to the second half of Section 5, JavaScript. I'll be covering event handlers and some of the UE libraries in this half. So first I want to start off with looking at this website. It's from PHPBB. It's a PHP script that has a free bulletin board. That's not what I'm here for. What I want to point out is this combo box or drop-down list that says jump to, and then it has a list of items that you can jump to on the website. That's basically just a list of the forums on this website. And basically, if you select one of these, let's try that. Actually, let's choose a different one. It automatically goes to another page. And so who can tell me how this is how this is managed? How can a user just select a box and the page automatically changes?
There's some JavaScript to do an action on selection.
Yeah, there's the answer was there's something in the JavaScript that fires when the drop down list when the selection in the drop down list changes, and that causes the page to change. So if we go to I just want to point out that I changed the section notes a little bit at 2 p.m. today. So if you downloaded and printed out the section notes before 2 p.m., then there are some changes in the code. So you might want to take a look at that. And also, the examples on my website, they're also linked from the sections page on the course website. But these have the correct code. So if you can't get the code in the original section notes to work, then please do refer to the newer versions. And the newer section notes has 1.1 written at the very bottom. If yours only has a page number, then that is version 1.0, which is the one with bugs. So with that said, let's take a look at the first example, my on-change example. This achieves what we just saw in the PHPBB forum script, the jump to drop-down list. And, okay, so let's take a look at the code. Okay, so basically I have here No JavaScript at all at the moment, just HTML. I have one form that submits to dostuff.php. The name is my form. There's one select box, which is the drop-down list that you saw. Select name is category, and we have a bunch of options. The default selected option is nothing, but we have three options. One is lectures, the other sections, and the other is forum. So basically, we have a list of pages on our website. Let's say this is the CS75 website. If we drop this, if you can see, can you see it in the back? This is basically a drop-down list with the three items. Now, this should be simple, but the problem here is that if we select a drop-down list at the moment, if we select an item at the moment, it's not going to do anything because basically it's a form with a select box and no submit button. There's no way that this form can be submitted because there's nothing in the code to submit it. So what we could do, as in previous sections and lectures, is to simply include a submit button at the end of this form, right here. But that wouldn't be very interesting. I mean, why would you be here if you already know how to do that? So what we want to do is we want to re-implement the PHPBB, the jump to drop-down list. We want to make sure that if a user selects one of these options, then he's or she is automatically transported to that page. So what can we do? So what do you think we should do?
JavaScript.
Yeah, JavaScript. Well, that's the point of the section. But more specifically, what? Yeah, so we have to submit this form on an onChange event. So we saw the onSubmitChange in the first half of this section. The onSubmit event handler we put in the form tag, and that was fired, so to speak, when the form was submitted by the user. Now, since we don't have a mechanism to submit the form at the moment, we can't use onSubmit. That wouldn't be very useful. We need something that actually submits. So we use the onChange handler of the select box. And this onChange handler fires every time the option changes in the select box, i.e. when the user clicks on the drop-down list and selects a different item. So let's do that right here. I have very fast typing skills. onChange equals this form submit. What is this form submit? What does this refer to?
That is working on the actual form.
Mm-hmm. This refers to the object that the JavaScript is currently working on. And what is the object that is currently being worked on? Not the document.
The select.
Yes, it's the select. So if you have an event handler, this always refers to the thing that fired the event. So in this case, the select box fired the onChange event because the select box changed. The document didn't change, but the select box did. So we have this, which refers to the select box, and then this form. Form is something new, but it's easy to guess what it means, right? What does it mean?
The form.
Yeah, it means the form. So if all of these, for example, the select item, the tag, and the input tag, these two have something in JavaScript. They own a property called .form, and form refers to the form that it's included in. So in this case, this.form refers to this form because the select box is inside this form. So this.form.submit. And it's very clear what .submit, this submit function is. It basically submits the form. So in other words, every time that this select box, a different option is selected in this select box, then we called the forms submit method. And this basically does the same thing as clicking on a regular submit button. So let's take a look at the result. If we see. Okay, so if we select something, and I think this will be cut off actually. I'll select an option. And then this is dostuff.php, basically prints out all the get and post variables. But we can see that. The get category variable has been set to sections because the option The option I selected was sections, and basically it's just done the same thing as a form submission, but just through JavaScript. Yes?
There's no, you don't have to put anywhere that, you know, the script tag, or, you know, like, mm-hmm. if you echo something in a form mm-hmm. in PHP, you have to put the little, you know.
Right.
But there's nothing, you know.
Oh,
there's nothing that announces that this is JavaScript.
That it's JavaScript, yeah. That's because it's, if you have one of these event handlers, such as onChange, onSubmit, and later we'll see onClick, onMouseOver, onMouseOut, all of these attributes beginning with on, these are implied to be JavaScript unless you say otherwise. And in this case, it really is JavaScript. So onChange will simply fire this as JavaScript. Does anyone have any more questions about the onChange example? Okay. So you might want to implement this in your projects, but one word of warning is that this presents some problems. One problem is that somebody using a non-JavaScript-enabled browser, and it's not just people who don't like JavaScript or who think the internet is dangerous. It's not just those people. It's people using web browsers that are geared for accessibility reasons. These people won't be able to access your pages in this range because obviously you have to have JavaScript to submit this form. So that's why the PHBBB forum, although it will submit on a JavaScript event, it also has an actual submit button called Go. So if you do want to implement something like this, a drop-down menu that has that acts like a navigation bar, then I would strongly suggest that you also implement a submit button next to the drop-down menu. You also see in JavaScript that you can actually meddle with the CSS of various elements on the page. So if you want, you can, upon detecting JavaScript, simply hide the extra submit button so that the user only sees a drop-down list if they support JavaScript. But if the user doesn't support JavaScript, then they see a simple select drop-down list along with a submit button, which they can click in any case. So that would be a good way to go about this problem. Okay, so got that. All right, so now I want to... So we mentioned onChange, there are various other event handlers, and I mentioned earlier on onMouseOver and onMouseOut. And as the names might suggest, onMouseOver is when the mouse cursor is over a certain object, and onMouseOut is the opposite of that, when the mouse cursor leaves the object. And these are two elements that we can use to create something like this. It's nice, but it's not very functional at the moment. Basically, when you hover over the image, then the image changes. So, who can guess how this is implemented?
Yeah, rollover function.
Yeah, it's a rollover function. So these are called image rollovers. And as the example name says, if you roll over the image, then the image is changed via JavaScript. So let's see how this is done. By the way, this isn't a very useful example because it changes it doesn't do anything visually. Well, it does do something visually, but it doesn't make much sense. Where it would make sense is if you have a button and two images, one with the button up and one with the button down. And do you often see that? Well, not that often maybe, but you can certainly see it on websites where if you go over a button, then the button sort of changes. Windows XP has that effect. If you have a checkbox, then if you roll over it, then the checkbox turns blue. And I think Windows Vista might have that effect. It's in some vogue. But if you want to implement that in JavaScript, you can do it pretty easily with the on mouse over and on mouse out events, and let's see how we do that. Okay, so right. So let's get rid of this for now. Ignore the script for now. This is just basically a body tag with one image that is basically image suruk images first image dot ping. First image dot ping is an image stored on our server, and it is the green state of the button that you saw. Now, we want to make sure that the image changes when our mouse rolls over it. So what do?
Put an on mouse over.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Handler.
Right, so we put an on mouse over event handler. And I've actually written the code already, but it's a very simple function. Function change to second image, my image. So how do we call this? How do we call this function?
Putting change to second image.
Mm-hmm.
Open paren this.
Yeah.
Close paren.
Mm-hmm. So can anyone tell me why this is required?
Because you're passing in a variable.
Yeah, so I'm passing in this, and in this case, what does this refer to?
The second image.
It refers to the image.
My image is here.
Yeah, it refers to this image, this image tag.
Right, right.
So into this function, we pass this, which is the image tag, and off we go to this function where we have where we set my image, a local variable, to reference to this image tag. And we simply say my image, which is this image dot Sirok. We're just changing the source of that image programmatically instead of typing it in statically. We say my image dot Sirok images second image dot ping. And as you may be able to guess, this basically just changes the source of this image tag to second image dot ping, causing the rollover. So now if we just save this and refreshed, you can see that. Did everyone catch that? Now, if you mouse over this, it changes, but it doesn't change back. Mm-hmm. Now, that's because I've just removed the on mouse out event handler, as you may have realized. But so we need to have two stages. When the mouse rolls over, we need to change the image. When the mouse rolls out, we need to change the image back. So, what should we do now? Besides on mouse over, we need on mouse out. On mouse out equals same thing, change back this. Oops, sorry. This basically calls this function, which does the same thing, just with a different image, which is the same image as the first one. It changes the image back. You may have also, I want to point out the semicolon. In this case, it's not required. That's because JavaScript automatically puts a semicolon at the end of any code, at the end of any line. So if it encounters the end, so this counts as an end of a line because this part is JavaScript, but this part is HTML. So this counts as the end of the line. So it would put a semicolon there anyway. But I'm just putting it in there because I want to. You can do the same. It will act just the same if you remove these semicolons.
How about if you remove the return mark so that it was all in one line?
I think it will be okay because everything outside of that JavaScript block is not JavaScript. Yeah. As I said, the end of this this JavaScript block denotes the end of the line as well. So it's okay to remove the semicolons here. So, does anyone have any questions about this? Not this, but this example. Okay. So, we didn't realize in this example, but if you're loading this page from a remote web server and the image happens to be really big, or your connection is really slow, then when you roll over this image for the first time, you'll find that the image takes a long time to load. You'll have the green image and then you'll roll over it, but it won't change for a few seconds. And that's a really bad, aesthetically it's really bad because you're not giving the user the feedback they want. So what we can do is to load the image in the background before this JavaScript on mouse over event is called. We can do that in several ways. What's an easy way to do it without using JavaScript?
Use the hidden attribute.
Mm-hmm. Yep, of CSS. You mean, yeah, right. So, so what we can do is just write a new image tag here saying images second image dot ping, and with CSS we can hide that using the hidden or the visibility hidden CSS attribute. That's okay, but it's not a very elegant way to do it, especially because JavaScript has a better way to do it. So what's a better way to do it? Oh, so do you all get why we need to download the image in the first place? Because this second image dot ping is only referred to in the JavaScript, the web browser doesn't know to cache the image or to download the image before this function is called. So basically, the first time this function is called is the first time that this image is downloaded from the server, hence causing the fetching and the delay. So we can put an image tag here so that the image will already be in the browser's cache, so that it can simply load the image from disk rather than loading it from the network. But as I said, there's another way to do it using JavaScript, and it's by using the JavaScript object image. We first create an image. Let's call it temp image. Okay, so image is a built-in JavaScript object denoting an internal representation of an image. So we say var temp image. This creates a new variable called temp image, and sets that to an empty or new image. So we can do temp image dot circ equals images second image dot ping. So now this will cause the new internal representation of an image called temp image to have the source of images second image dot ping, and almost magically, just setting the source will cause the file to be downloaded. So if we say dot circ and this, then the image will be downloaded to the browser's cache, and that's all we need to do to get the image to be cached beforehand. You'll see this in the example 7, rollover cache.html. So some of this is different. You'll see on the course website this example, but I've actually implemented the load image the image loading functions in a separate function called function load image, and if you notice, this is actually in the head tag instead of the body tag, and you put functions in the head tag when you want to define new functions but don't necessarily want them to run at that instance at that moment. So we don't want load image to we don't want it to run immediately after the browser's loaded the HTML page. So we've put this in a function in the head tag, and if you notice here, we've used another event handler called onload, and onload is actually a very special event handler used for the body tag, and this is basically called when the HTML page finishes loading. So when the web browser is done with creating all the divs, you know, creating tables, downloading all the images, then it asks the JavaScript interpreter to call the onload event for the body tag, and basically it works just the same as any other event handler, on change, on submit. These are all the same. So when the page is finished loading, this code says load the image, call this function. So our function gets executed. When the page has been loaded, so it's the same thing as simply writing this code above here, but it's simply more elegant because people writing JavaScript tend to put initialization statements in the onload event, and so this is basically by convention and by necessity, not so much. But it's a good idea to put initialization statements in the onload event handler. If you take a good look at the UI library, the Yahoo UI library, you'll find that it has a utility called event, and using it, you can subscribe onload events to it, which means that you don't need to specify onload, but instead you use a different JavaScript method designated by Yahoo's API documentation, and you can do it that way. But basically, that also uses internally, it uses the onload event handler to do all that stuff. Okay.
So you had a there you're just using one function to load one image.
Mm-hmm.
If you had, let's say, a list of 10 images that you wanted to load up, could you like put the source names in an array,
mm-hmm.
and then use like a for loop to do that temp image again and again?
Mm-hmm. So if you had multiple images instead of just one image that you had to load, then you could specify all the image names in an array and then use a for loop to loop over all those images and load them. And that's a commonly used tactic on web pages that use multiple buttons that you can roll over. It's often so. If you look at some websites, you'll find that they have a navigation bar, similar to what I have on my website. It's similar to this. If you look closely, the color changes. I'm not using any JavaScript here because I'm not a big fan of using JavaScript because it has accessibility issues. But if you roll over, on some web pages, these will be implemented using JavaScript and rollovers and images. If you roll over, for example, so this uncolored state or unhighlighted state will be one image, and then the highlighted state will be another image. And so you have to load these highlighted images or highlighted state images using an array, so that you can efficiently load all of them in one go. But as I said, this is implemented using CSS and not JavaScript. Okay, so does anyone have any additional questions about the image rollover effect or the various events that we covered? Okay, so now we're on to a completely different topic, using the Yahoo UE library. Has anyone tried using the UE library? Any of its? No?
Just a quick one last mm-hmm. question, I'm sorry.
Yes.
There's on mouse over and on mouse out. Mm-hmm. What is it called for on click or something?
It's called on click.
On click?
Yeah, okay. So on click is an event handler used when you click on an object. Yeah. Oh, there's also on mouse up and on mouse down. So that's used when, for example, you want to implement a drag and drop function. You on mouse down, because you push the button down on an object and then you drag it and then you mouse up. So that's two events. And or you could implement it using on mouse click, but that wouldn't work for a drag and drop. Yeah. So if you want to look up these all of these events, then there's a good website that is linked from the resources page on the course website. Let's see if we can find it. It's called the JavaScript object. And if we go here. Okay, so this page basically provides a tree view of the JavaScript DOM, the document object model. And it's, for example, you can see that BG color is an attribute of document. This is very small. So using this page, you can see what's under document. What you can see what style is. You can actually find out that there's a cookie attribute, which you can use to access the cookies that have been set by the server. There's all sorts of. So for example, you can see that the checked attribute was actually a built-in attribute that belongs to any input or text area or select. As we saw in the first portion of this section, we use checked to see if a checkbox was checked, and we can actually see for ourselves that these properties actually exist. And when you click on one of these properties on this website, you'll find out what it is, and it says this actually uses an alert box of its own. This boolean says if a checkbox or radio button is checked, and it says read-write, which means you can actually programmatically check a box using JavaScript. If it said read-only, then it would mean that you can only read the value. But since it's read-write, you can actually check a box using JavaScript. Okay. Oh, so it seems like Firefox 3 beta actually got rid of the JavaScript application caption, and it just says the page at the URL says, which is more user-friendly, but you still can't change it. Yeah. Okay, so the Yahoo UE library. The website is at developer.yahoo.com/UE, and if you've been to this website at all, you'll realize that UE is actually composed of various controls and utilities. Did we see any examples during lecture this week? Which example?
The tree
thing, and the file tree.
Yeah. So the tree was one of those controls down there. We can also see that there are things like autocomplete, button, calendar, charts. Charts is really cool. There's all sorts of various controls and utilities that you may find useful in writing your own JavaScript or Ajax-y websites. We'll find in later lectures that I believe David is thinking of using the Yahoo UE library to implement Ajax, JavaScript becomes a very writing complex JavaScript applications just becomes more easy with UE and the various other libraries that exist on the internet. So today I thought we'd cover the calendar control, which basically creates a calendar on the on your web page. And we can see multiple examples of this. One is loanspot.org. This is this calendar is implemented using Yahoo's calendar module. And you see that when you click on one of these when you click on one of these days, you go to a different portion of the website, or basically it selects another day. Yeah. So that's one example of how to use the calendar. Let's see how we can use it for ourselves. Okay. So it's actually not all that hard to use these Yahoo libraries, because they have very comprehensive documentation in the form of examples, which are always linked from the top of the control page. And this API documentation, which you can use when you're unsure of what a property means, or if you want to use an advanced method that isn't covered in the examples, you'll want to look at the API documentation to look for specific properties and methods. But if you just want to get started, you can just scroll down on this page, and it guides you through the process of implementing one of these controls, in this case, calendar. And if you just follow the instructions and copy and paste this code, then you will end up with a functioning Yahoo control. So I won't do the copy and pasting process right here because we'll run out of time, but I will just show you this. This is the result of 30 seconds worth of going through the Yahoo page and then copying and pasting all the code that Yahoo provided. They told me to copy and paste this code into my head tag, so I did. They told me to put this here, so I did. And I don't know if this was mentioned in the documentation, it probably is, but if you use a Yahoo control, you have to make sure that your body has a class of UE Skin Sam. This is so that Yahoo's CSS can go through all the objects in your body tag. If you don't have this, then you'll end up with a Yahoo control that works, but doesn't look at all like what it should be.
Can you have multiple class attributes?
Yes, you can. You can do that by simply doing. So you can specify multiple CSS classes using spaces.
How about that?
Okay. So, right. So this just to explain this code. This was provided by Yahoo, but it basically is an empty div that serves as the placeholder for the calendar. Yahoo's libraries will populate this for us. We don't need to worry about the internal representation of a calendar. And this script tag is what I was told to paste by Yahoo. It creates a new variable called cal1, and it creates a new object, yahoo.widget.calendar. This is also provided by the code. And this attribute, this argument here, this one basically refers to this container, and it just tells Yahoo which container to write to. and then I call cal1.render. Render is a built-in Yahoo UE calendar method that renders a calendar. And so if we call this, then we magically end up with a calendar in this div. Oh, and one thing I wanted to note is that if you're copying and pasting the code from Yahoo's websites, that their code is actually HTML and not XHTML. So if you click on one of their copy and pastings, paste windows, you'll find that there's a link rel tag. But, aha, what's wrong with this? Yeah, it's not closed properly. So this is HTML, not XHTML. So it's not hard to just convert that to XHTML. I've just done that with two extra characters, space, forward slash. So,
do you suppose they had a good reason for that?
I don't know. I think Yahoo's websites are written in HTML instead of XHTML. That may be for performance reasons, because they don't include a whole DTD. Actually, their Yahoo UE website might, but their main search website doesn't. So, and also, major corporations tend not to worry so much about validating their code. This isn't a very good idea, and I strongly discourage this. So, if you're writing code for your own company, I would suggest that you do write in XHTML. This is for multiple reasons that I've talked about on the forum on several occasions. The take-home message is XHTML is good. So, just remember that.
And those script tags with the source files, I mean, they're...
Okay, so...
They could also be self-closing, right?
I tried that a few years ago, and it didn't work. I don't know if it works now, but I believe that with a script tag, you must always open and then close it, even though it looks stupid. I think if you do otherwise, then it will not work, at least in the browser I was using at that time. Let's see if it does. Okay, so if we go to this calendar example, which I've now modified... Yeah, the calendar doesn't work. So, So do the slightly idiotic representation of a script tag by opening it and then having nothing in there and then closing it. I don't know why it is. I would prefer it to simply do this, but that's how it is. So now we've fixed that, and the calendar works. So we have a fully functioning calendar here. And it's actually very cool, because you can select multiple, you can select dates, you can page through multiple months. It's very cool, and it would take several hours of coding to come up with something like this. So Yahoo's saved us a lot of work by implementing this. But at the moment, it isn't terribly useful. I mean, it tells us what days of the week correspond to which days, but that's about all it does. So what we can do is to hook into this calendar control to subscribe to events that this control fires. This control actually fires several events over the course of its existence. For example, if you mouse, if you mouse over a day, it'll fire an event. If you click on a day, if you start clicking on a day, it'll fire an event. If you finish clicking on an event, it'll fire an event. So there are various events that you can hook into. But one event that I want to look into today is the select event. And as the name might suggest, so the select event is fired when a day is selected in the calendar. So this one is in example 9, calendarclick.html. I'll show you the result first. If you go to UE calendar clickable example, if we click on a date, then we get an alert box with the selected day. And how we implement this, for PHP, we had separate files for .php and .phps, because we couldn't let you see the source without changing the file extension. But for HTML and JavaScript, of course, all the source code is available for you just by clicking on view page source or the equivalent feature on your web browser. You see, this is Firefox as an example, but the script tag has all the JavaScript code. As Dan mentioned, JavaScript is not hidden from a user. For a user to run JavaScript, then they have to see the full source code. So so we don't have separate links for the source code of the JavaScript examples. Okay. So this is the clickable version of our UE calendar example. Nothing's changed in the head tag. We've got the link tag, which we've converted to XHTML in the previous example. We've got the two script dependencies. By the way, you can remove you can remove these empty lines and these comments to make it neater. But I've just left them in to show that I've just copied and pasted from the Yahoo website. Okay, so if we go down. Okay, so now if we look at this line, let me move that over a little bit. Nothing has changed here. I'm just creating the same old cal1 variable, and here I'm in this line, I'm rendering that calendar. But I'm doing something new here in this second line. What does it look like? Cal1.selectEvent. What does that sound like? What is it? What could it be a representation of?
Somebody clicking a day.
Right. Yeah. So the event is when someone clicks on a day. This select event. This basically represents an event of someone clicking a day. So cal1.selectEvent. That's an object that Yahoo's predefined. Cal1.selectEvent, and it takes and it has several methods, and one method is subscribe. And this is what I was talking about earlier, of subscribing to events. So you say, please, Mr. Yahoo control, calendar control, if you receive the select event, then please call me. And so that's what this this line is doing. It's saying, if you receive the select event, then please subscribe me to this. And it's like a magazine subscription. Please send the event to this address. And that's all it's doing. So in this case, the select event will be sent to my select handler, which is a function we've defined here. I'll get to that later. My select handler, and if you look at the API documentation or the examples on the Yahoo Calendar website, you'll see that it takes three arguments. My select this is the select handler. This is the actual calendar that we're referring to, and I forget what this boolean value was. You can look it up in the API documentation, but in this case, I did this late at night yesterday, and I totally forgot. But if you're curious, you can look it up in the API documentation. In this case, we can leave it at true. No questions, please. Okay, so I mentioned the select handler right up here. And this is very similar to it's very similar to an example we saw in the first half of the section, right? What is it similar to, this thing? It's very similar to the prototype that we defined, string.prototype.trim equals function. That's because this is another lambda function, a nameless function. Basically, it's saying my select handler is a function that takes three arguments and does the following, the following code that's included in the braces. And so I should have indented this nicely. Okay, so this is what it should look like. This is basically one variable, a statement that creates a new variable, these four lines. And so, as I said, this is a nameless function that takes three arguments. And these three arguments are type, args, which stands for arguments, and obj, which is the object that's being referred to. So in this case, what arguments do we need to get? Because we want to print out the year, month, and day.
Month, day, year.
Yeah, month, day, year. So basically, we want to get all the days that were selected in the calendar. And just to mention, this Yahoo calendar control does support multi-selecting of days. In its default state, it doesn't support that. But this looks very very convoluted. What is this basically doing? Args square bracket zero square bracket zero.
Defining a range.
Yes.
Like a beginning and end value. I mean, that's the intent.
Well, it's actually taking. So args is an array of arguments that the event handler sends. And in this case, this select event handler only sends one argument. So args 0 takes the first argument. And that first argument is in itself an array of days.
Oh,
Yeah, so it's an array of array of arrays, because the days themselves are arrays of year, month, and day. So it's a three-dimensional array. So it's very confusing, but this is also explained in the API documentation, so I would strongly suggest you look at that if you're using any of the Yahoo libraries. And so in the footnotes of the section notes, on page 7, or which is the last page, I've put a list of footnotes. Some of these footnotes with the various links to the API documentation. So please do take a look if you're wondering what the true and false here was that I waved my hands at. So this is basically just taking the first argument, which is the array of days, and it's taking the first day. And it's taking the first day because the Yahoo calendar control supports selecting multiple days. And of course, we're only selecting one day here because in this case, we haven't selected we haven't set the appropriate property that allows the calendar to have multiple days selected. So we're doing arg00 to get the first day that's selected, or which is the only day that's selected. And we're using the same alert function that we've seen in previous examples. And we're saying, var selected equals arg00 means this is now an alias of this. It's a copy of that data. So selected 0 is the year, because as I said, the day is represented in this control as year, month, day. So selected 0 is getting the first or 0th element of the array, which is the year. Selected 1 is getting the first or the second element of the array, which is the month. And then that says selected 2, which is the day. So 0, year, 1, month, 2, day. So it's not that hard, right? If we click on a day, then we get the days. We get the day that was selected. This isn't very useful at the moment because why would you want a message box to point out what day you've selected? You can see that for yourself. So what useful thing can we do? So going back to that example we saw earlier of loanspot.org. This is actually a website that David created. If you click on, so we saw that if we clicked on one of these days, we went to another day represented in the calendar. I assume he uses the select event handler to handle this. So when you, it probably calls another Lambda function that does things with the URL. So what we want to do is do things with the URL. Let's go back to this example. Let's say we have a blog, and you'll see that in recent blogs, the URL is something like something blog year month day. Have you seen these URLs? These are called clean URLs or pretty URLs, and sometimes we'll want to click on a calendar day and then navigate to that URL. Does that seem like a fair project? It's also very simple using this Yahoo event handler. What we can do is call the window.location.replace function, and this is a function that it belongs in the window. This is something else that we haven't seen yet, but it's basically the parent of the document. So window is the ultimate parent of all JavaScript function JavaScript properties and methods in the JavaScript DOM. It stands at the root of the tree. And if you go back to that website that I showed you a few minutes ago, you'll see that the window is at the very top of that tree, signifying that it's the container of everything. It represents everything in the JavaScript world. So window.location, that means the location of this window. So window means the parent of everything, but it also means that it represents the window, the web browser window.
The URL.
Yes, so window.location represents the URL. Yeah, and what we're doing here is calling the replace method of that location with... So what we can actually do window.location equals I don't know, replaces a convention, I guess, and I've been using it for a number of years, but window.location is a simple string, so you can read and write to it. So if you read window.location, you'll get the current URL. And if you set window.location, then the page will suddenly change. So let's say we'd say this will have to be a non-existent URL, but date. So how can we put the year here? We want to do it in a format like this, / blog.
Now go on the other side of the quote and do a plus.
Plus.
Selected bracket zero.
Yep, selected bracket zero. And plus, yeah, same thing. We're just concatenating a URL, a string, like we might have done with PHP. Yeah, so this basically creates a URL of this form. And just to show that it works, let's save this page and refresh. And when we click on a alert, well, this alert it comes before the window.location line, so it's going to fire anyway. But if we click OK, we go to a different URL, which we just generated. That's the URL /blog/2008/3/22, which is the day we selected. So now this navigation is, as you can see, probably quite useful and quite simple to use for something like this, for a blog, for example. Yes, do you have a question?
So does it actually send the user to that location? Or
yeah, it actually sends the user to that location. It's the same thing as a meta refresh, which you might have seen in older web pages where you go to a different page. It basically makes the web browser send the user to a different page. So it's very useful if you want to have a redirect, for example, in JavaScript.
Could, since you were writing and composing the URL, you could make the URL look like a query string as well.
Yeah, that's right.
It's not doing a get, but as you say, it's just doing a switch to the location, but you could make it look like a query string.
Yeah. Okay. So the question was, could you make the URL look like a query string? And so, yes, if you in your source code, if you set window.location equals some URL question mark with some query strings, then and then you send using that code, you could send the user to a different page with some get variables associated with it. So instead of doing this pretty URL thing, you could say blog question mark year equals 2008 and month equals 3 and day equals 22. We can do that too. We can do anything as long as it's URL and as long as you can send people to that URL. Window.location is the thing to do. Okay, so does anyone have any questions about this example, this calendar control? Yes?
In reference to what he was saying, if it's going to another page, doesn't it have to send some type of HTTP header or like get or something?
Oh, no, it does not, because window.location, so the question was, does it need to send any HTTP headers with the request? No, because window.location is handled automatically by the web browser, and it has the same effect of a user typing in a URL and then hitting enter. Okay, so it's not an HTTP request. It is, but that's hidden away. That's done by the browser. So all the JavaScript is doing is saying, please transfer the user to this new URL. So the JavaScript interpreter is just making the browser do that.
But if you sort of sniff the headers, if you sniff the traffic coming out of your system, would you see something?
Oh, yes, of course. You'll see the same thing that would be generated by a user request.
Okay.
Yeah. Okay. So any other questions about the Yahoo UI library or how we did window.location? Okay, if not, then that's the end of this section, and see you next week.
Thank you.
Thank you.